From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Republican tax cut fails to clear the House in Lansing, and there's been plenty of chaos there since that overnight vote. Plus, how colleges and universities should do more for non-traditional students who make up three-quarters of our college student population.
They may be ex-incarcerated. They may be factory workers who lost their jobs. So it's a whole universe of people who need college and want to be in college and don't fit that picture that we have.
And then poet Cindy Hunter Morgan explores the tragedy of Great Lakes shipwrecks.
There's still people on board confronting possibility or the certainty of death.
And hunting coyotes in Michigan. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Disarray, chaos among House Republicans in Lansing. The bill to cut Michigan's personal income tax was defeated very early this morning. That income tax cut was a top priority of brand new Republican House Speaker Tom Leonard. But in the end, he couldn't muster the votes when 12 Republicans voted no, including Representative Jason Shepard, who changed his yes to a no, and the Speaker wasn't happy.
The representative from Monroe County looked me in the eyes, told me he was going to be a yes vote, and voted no.
Well, our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are here now, ready to sink their teeth into this.
There were some fighting words.
Tell you what. So this was quite a marathon overnight session, wasn't it, Rick?
This was quite a marathon overnight session, and it took until about 2 a.m. before the bill even actually was put up on the board and they started voting on it. A lot of negotiations. You might remember that originally that this was a four-decade phase-out of the income tax, but a lot of people, including many Republicans and including our CPA nerd governor, Rick Snyder, saying it's too much, that there's no plan here for cutting spending, for coming up with new revenue. And what's at stake here is schools, local services, police and fire, and those ever-important infrastructure investments that we're talking about. And so in the end, after meeting for 13 hours, the vote happened. They came up three votes short, a dozen Republicans voting no, one Democrat voting yes.
Well, Zoe, the House Speaker, he wanted this thing badly. Why did he want it so badly right out of the gate?
Well, sure. And as Rick talked about, I mean, one of the talking points is, you know, middle class tax cuts, that this would help the average worker. We've done some math, Rick and I, though, and actually for an average salary of like $51,000 in Michigan, a taxpayer would have saved about $82 a year. That is less than $7 a month. But there was that, you know, we want to do what Republicans do, save money. But behind all of those waves, let's go to the calm water underneath.
Yes.
And that is 2018 is an election year, and Tom Leonard would like to run for state attorney general.
Mm-hmm. The idea,
and he's likely going to have a primary opponent, maybe someone even in the Senate. And if you want to absolutely show that you are a conservative, particularly as House leader, then you push this through. Now, I say a primary. This will actually be a convention. Republicans, very, mm-hmm. very, you know, strong-willed Republicans will vote on this. This looks good when you are debating between Republicans whether or not you are voting for this. That is what's going on behind all of
this. So he wanted to slap that card down on the table.
A lot of people saw this as the opening line of a convention speech. I'm Tom Leonard, and as your Republican House Speaker, the first thing I did was keep the promise of rolling back your income taxes.
Now, there's been chaos since this vote. Let's start, Rick. Tell us what happened to Representative Jason Shepard after he changed his mind and voted no.
Well, Jason Shepard, he lost his gavel chairing the House Financial Services Committee that you heard Tom Leonard talking about that at you played that cut at the beginning of this segment. And he said it was because Leonard said it was because Jason Shepard lied to him about his yes vote. But a lot of people are looking at that and saying, well, you know, first of all, we know that this potential punishment has been dangling over Shepard for like a couple of weeks. If you don't get on board, then you might lose your chairmanship. And he was the only chair who voted against it. There were some budget subcommittee chairs, but this is just a sort of evidence of the hardball that the speaker might be willing to play when he doesn't get his way.
And then, speaking of chaos, there was supposed to be a press conference earlier this afternoon. Representative Dave Pagel of Berrien Springs. What happened? Because it was canceled, right?
It was. First, he called it. He said he was going to call for an investigation into how Speaker Leonard handled this income tax rollback vote and the negotiations that led up to it. And he called the press conference, and then he canceled the press conference. A lot of confusion.
And you got off the phone with him just a little while ago, Rick.
Just a little while ago, and he sounded exhausted, but he said he's frustrated and he wants some answers.
The vote that I've been entrusted with by 90,000 people back home is too valuable to give up unless I'm convinced it's the right policy. And I felt pressure. I think all of us felt a lot of pressure to change our votes.
Zoe, what's going on here?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's this political idea of either you strong arm or, you know, you dangle things if you're the leader to get it done. But in the end, I mean, I think democracy and the American people and voters kind of want their representatives to vote what they believe, vote their districts. And so that's what he did. Now, there's confusion about whether he, you know, yes, lied or not and all of these things. But I mean, what we're trying to figure out here is what happened. And I think everyone who watched this last night can basically say this was not handled well.
Rick, what's your take?
Well, first of all, that the House Republican leadership has shown that they need to learn how to manage the floor.
And
it
count
is
votes.
Part of the, and count votes. That they put this up knowing that they didn't have enough votes and hope for the best. And so that's, you know, managing the floor is part of the job. So that's something that they're going to have to build on. They're going to have to answer some questions. We just heard from Dave Pagel, who said that, you know, they're going to go in to their closed-door caucus meetings next week, and he's going to say, I want to have a discussion about the tactics that were used, whether or not threats were made, whether or not there was strong arming going on, and whether or not we're going to respect the independence of the of caucus members. And there's one other thing that, you know, they can say that they wanted to, you know, get their positions on the income tax rollback up on the board and on the record. But if the goal was to get a policy adopted, well, that didn't happen. There are two things that we know for certain right now when it comes to this particular issue. And one of them is that this income tax rollback effort seems stalled, if not stopped. And the other is that the House Republican caucus is looking for a good relationship counselor.
It's interesting drama to watch. And I know that we'll have lots to dig into as this continues to play out. Thanks so much, our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta.
Opportunities.
Part of the community.
The next idea.
You almost feel like in the back of your head, like these people don't know exactly what happened.
With all the talk of reforming healthcare, what if we're missing the bigger picture? What if all this emotional debate about whether to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, is pretty much a waste of time? The next idea is Jeff DeGraff thinks that when it comes to making profound changes in healthcare, innovation will play a greater role than legislation.
In 2013, I was asked to give a TED Talk in Washington, D.C. to coincide with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. I was to follow the Surgeon General, the Director of the National Institutes of Health, and a well-known Harvard Business School professor, among others. I immediately said, no thanks. I didn't want to be like Frank Gorshin, the impersonator who came on the Ed Sullivan Show right after the Beatles made their American debut. After some cajoling, I agreed to do the event with the stipulation that I could invite a panel of healthcare innovators and pretend to be Oprah. Surprisingly, they agreed. Top innovators from Google, AT&T, Lockheed Martin, and Qualcomm joined me in a very pleasant, non-confrontational discussion about how healthcare was being changed from the outside in. We discussed the use of smartphones to perform physical exams in record time for less than $15. Diagnosis of diseases like river blindness with the addition of a cheap lens attachment for handheld devices, crowdfunding the discoveries of new drugs, using open-source informatics to create inexpensive and customized therapies, and more. In the weeks that followed, I received a few polite but passive-aggressive emails from people I took to be seasoned physicians. The message was usually the same: you don't understand how we do things because you're not a doctor. I also received several emails from medical students and residents. Their message went something like this: the attending physicians in my medical center are terrified of new technology. Please send help. Finally, I received numerous inquiries from young entrepreneurs who wanted to be outside-in innovators themselves. Most of them were looking for moral support, industry connections, and large amounts of cash. It was clear that all three groups belonged to the same healthcare ecosystem, but with much more eco and much less system. What has been conspicuously absent from the discussion about reforming healthcare is the role innovation is playing in making it better, faster, and cheaper. While we are lobbying and legislating the future of healthcare in America, innovators are creating the products and services that will largely determine what that future looks like. Ideally, doctors would be leading the effort, but they're falling behind the pace of the innovators. The irony is that healthcare is great at developing timely new therapies, but terrible at operationalizing them. It's a difficult balancing act. We expect our physicians to follow the rules so that they get predictable results. But if we don't give them room to try new things, innovators will come from somewhere else. Over the past few years, I've been working with some of the leading medical institutions to teach students and physicians how to make innovation happen from the outside in. The results have been promising so far, but there is much more to do before we see any real impact on the availability and affordability of healthcare. Its future will obviously be affected by the decisions of our elected representatives, but the ideas coming from these outside innovators will likely matter much more in the end.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea. You'll find his essay at the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our Great Lakes, beautiful, bewitching, and ferocious. The Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum tells us the lakes have claimed some 6,000 ships and 30,000 lives. And it is that grim yet compelling history that Cindy Hunter Morgan explores in her new collection of poems, Harborless.
Chicora, 1895, Lake Michigan. Cups and plates spilled into the lake, a terrible clattering, lost among splitting timbers. The fury was so great it exceeded sound, numbed the ears of a coal passer, who paused, mute on the tilted deck, and spotted the dishes in torrent and foam. They looked as though they were soaking in soap suds. A dipper from a gravy bowl spinning on the surface, cream from a milk crock swirling in liquid as dark as the sky. Some men he knew had already tasted it, were sinking beneath a new Milky Way.
Cindy Hunter Morgan, welcome to Stateside. That poem you just read us is called Chicora, 1895. It really paints some vivid and terrible images of the aftermath of the sinking of the Chicora. What do we know about what happened to her?
Well, she crossed Lake Michigan after the shipping season was really supposed to be over. The lake was partially frozen. The boat made it over to Milwaukee. It left from St. Joseph in Michigan, made it over to Milwaukee, and then it was unloaded. And about 15 minutes after it left Milwaukee for the return trip, a telegraph message was sent to the docks warning the captain not to sail, because the barometer was falling. But it was too late. The message didn't make it, and the ship disappeared. No bodies were recovered. But after the storm, searchers found a line of wreckage frozen in ice along the shore near Saugatuck.
So many stories in this book. This is really the telling. You're telling of 40 shipping disasters on the Great Lakes, and it's such a sense of timing, and if there'd just been an extra 15 minutes, that story would have been completely different.
Yeah, it's a moment of probably, I can only imagine, mm-hmm. great clarity and a kind of dissolution of all else that matters.
And I'm wondering what it was like for you, Cindy, as you were writing these poems, to spend that time contemplating those moments between life and death for these mariners and passengers. I mean, where did your mind and imagination take you?
Many places. In fact, all of these poems contain these imaginative moments, and I think that's what makes them poetry. That's where the balance shifts and tips them toward poetry, and that's where they become poems, are in those imaginative moments. They all have some, or they most have some nugget of historical accuracy, but then they do shift into this imaginative territory, and so my head went many places.
Yeah, and the book's time frame spans from wrecks that precede the Civil War to those involving, you know, modern vessels. Did that change the way that you approached or researched each poem?
No, not really. There's still people on board confronting the possibility or the certainty of death. And so that kind of confrontation likely doesn't change too much across the centuries. And in the end, that's what I'm exploring, is I'm exploring the human element here. And that kind of terror and sadness, I'm sure there were a whole mix of emotions. And I don't think those change across centuries.
As you say, starting with history and then using your imagination to take us to those moments. I'd like you to read another poem, but first tell us what it's about. The Philadelphia in 1893. What happened to that ship?
Sometimes it's interesting for me to think about, well, what started this poem? Where did it start? How did it start? And a lot of these poems started with an image or the concept of an image. And for me, the Philadelphia started with this image of these stoves at the bottom of the lake. So the Philadelphia sank in 1893. It was a steamer, and it collided with another steamer, the Albany. And the wreck is mostly intact, as is the cargo. And that image of this sort of mostly intact cargo still at the bottom of the lake is how this poem started for me. The cargo, it rests on the deck, and some of it's scattered on the bottom of the lake next to the hull. And it's part of the Thumb Area Bottomland Preserve in Lower Lake Huron.
Well, I'd love if you'd read it for us, please.
Sure. Philadelphia, 1893, Lake Huron. The ship sank with a load of cast iron stoves, which tumbled, lopsided, through white foam, green water, teal water, water as dark as coal, then darker. From deck to lake floor, they dropped 200 feet, plummeting past the white faces of lost men who stared, gaping. One man, hit by a stove, grasping for something, swung his legs around the belly of another stove sinking beside him and rode it to the bottom. When it settled in silt, he slipped off, an arm floating across his forehead, and slumped, exhausted, near the hearth. Wreck of a boy in November, done with chores.
Cindy Hunter Morgan reading her poem Philadelphia, 1893, from her new collection, Harborless. You know, as I went through these poems, it struck me, you do a really tremendous job of creating a sense of place on a ship that may have existed over a century ago. Are you a sailor or someone in your family a mariner? You really seem to take us there.
Well, thank you. My mom and dad used to have a cottage in Bayview near Petoskey. It's an association of old Victorian summer cottages. And that's on Little Traverse Bay. And we could go down there and for $10 a day rent a little sunfish, which we did frequently. Mm-hmm. So I have really fond memories of sailing in Little Traverse Bay with my dad. And those boats are like little corks. And, you know, for days after sailing, I would feel the boat in not just my legs, in my whole body. I could feel that kind of swell and descent, that kind of rhythm. It was just lovely and kind of magical. My great-grandpa, my grandma's father, sailed the lakes on a U.S. Corps of Engineers tug to earn money to pay for her college. She went to Michigan Agricultural College in the 1920s, which is now Michigan State University. But he sailed the Great Lakes to pay for that college experience for her.
You think a lot of families in Michigan probably have those kinds of stories that echo where somebody in the family earned a trade sailing the Great Lakes, and you really do remind us of the risk behind that. Would you read us one more poem?
Sure. Henry Clay, 1851, Lake Erie. Baled wool washed ashore for weeks. At first, the appearance of each bundle was sobering and macabre. But after a few days, one woman began to look forward to the surprise and the wealth of what drifted her way. She ripped the jute bags and pulled out the stuffing, wet, still scented with grease and mystery. She dried the wool, carded it, spun it, wound it into skeins, and made scarves and sweaters. 16 men died when the ship sunk. At least something would come of the cargo they carried. Mittens for the children of friends, caps for 5 nephews. Sometimes she wondered why bales floated and men didn't, and what buoyancy meant for her own life, dry as it was.
Cindy Hunter Morgan, her new collection of poems is Harborless. She teaches creative writing and book arts at Michigan State University, and we have information on upcoming readings by just going to the stateside link at michiganradio.org. Cindy Hunter Morgan, congratulations on this beautiful collection. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much.
Consumption is a disease that has truly left its mark on poetry and literature. Many a famous writer has killed off a character with consumption. And then there, of course, is the stereotype of the poet wasting away from lung disease. And that is our cue to welcome University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell here with us to talk about the last gasps of John Keats. So here we are, Dead Poet Society time. Keats really is the very definition of the English Romantic poet, isn't he?
He is indeed. He's one of the best poets probably after Shakespeare in the English language. I'm a frustrated English professor. I was an English major here at Michigan. So it's always a joy to get to read someone like John Keats again.
And a spoiler alert, on this day in 1821, John Keats died of?
Tuberculosis, or as they called it, that consumption, hence the last gasp of John Keats.
And there's a rather sad irony in the fact that Keats actually trained for a career in medicine.
Yes, that's something that very few people know. So he... Well, his father died when he was a young man, a young boy, and his mother left the family, so he was reared by his grandparents and then a guardian. And his guardian said, you know, maybe you should get a job that you can make some money at.
Learn a trade,
right.
Kid.
And medicine was then a trade. So at 15, he was apprenticed to an apothecary surgeon named Thomas Hammonds for a lot of money. It was £210 for room and board for a 5-year period. That's about almost $18,000 today. And he learned how to set fractures and how to bleed people and deliver babies and compound medicines. But he also was a house pupil at the famous Guy's Hospital in London. It's no longer around, but it was one of the great hospitals of the 19th and much of the 20th century.
So when you say apothecary surgeon, is that a physician or was there a different pecking order of medicine?
Well, there is a very distinct pecking order at that time and to this day to some extent in Great Britain. It's sort of like a pyramid. So at the apex is the physician. These are doctors who trained and studied and got a degree at Oxford or Cambridge or Edinburgh. And they were considered the most knowledgeable of doctors, and they saw the most well-heeled or richest of patients, and hence they charged the highest of fees. And then there were surgeons. Now, surgeons, as you may or may not know, were affiliated with barbers, mm-hmm. the barber surgeon.
That's the barber pole.
Exactly.
Yes.
With the red line is the blood going down. And barbers at that time did bleed as well as give people trims. But the surgeons separated from them and developed their own Royal Society of Surgeons in the early 1800s. And they were licensed to practice, but they were still just a notch below. They were considered craftsmen by the snooty physicians. And to this day, a surgeon in Great Britain is referred to as Mr. Jones rather than Dr. Jones. The physician retains that title of doctor.
And then apothecary, is that what we would call a pharmacist?
Initially, that's what they were. They would compound medicines and they would explain the medications. But there were very few physicians and there were very few surgeons out in the countryside in the provinces. So by 1815, apothecaries, by Act of Parliament, had various examinations and things that you had to do so that they could not only dispense medication, but they could diagnose and treat patients as well.
So John Keats picked up some pretty good medical skills. So the question is, here he is, a young man. Yeah. Did he ever see a patient?
He never saw a patient as a doctor. When he graduated, he was a year under the age of consent. He was 20 years of age, and you could not practice until you were 21. So he took a year off. He took a gap year.
before sharpened his pen?
yeah. Before they were called gap years, he took one. He sharpened his quill, and he began writing poetry. And some of it was quite bad. But he developed and got better and better very quickly. And by the time he was 25, he had written several masterpieces.
And do we know how he acquired consumption?
Well, they say he was taking care of his brother Tom, who died in 1819. And while he was taking care of Tom, he may have inhaled the tuberculosis germ. That is possible. You know, a lot of people shared beds and bedrooms at that time. And you have to be with someone who is very actively consumptive. They're coughing up the bacilli for 8 or more hours to contract it. So it could have been when Tom was sick. It could have been earlier. Who knows? But the story is he contracted it from his younger brother.
And did I see somewhere when he first coughed up blood, he knew that was it?
Well, yeah, near the end of his life. This is wonderful. So he was sent off to Italy on an ocean voyage. Many doctors prescribed that for young men of means for all sorts of things. When he got to Italy, he was taken care of by a man named James Clark, who is not been well served in the history of medicine. He's often referred to as incompetent or as a quack. In the end, it doesn't matter who took care of John Keats because he had such bad consumption, he would have died no matter what. Now, near the end, near the very end of John Keats's life, he coughed up bright red blood. And he knew that this was arterial blood. And he said, I know this color. I am not long for this world. So he diagnosed his own demise, yes.
What did it mean to suffer from TB? Because it's something that we in 2017, thankfully, don't really have to worry about.
It was awful. I mean, consumption is a wonderful name for the disease because once the bacilli is rampant, it consumes with a fiery pace. It destroys the lung tissue. It destroys other tissues. And as it destroys the lung tissue, it then destroys arteries. And that's why you cough up blood. But you also can't breathe very well to begin with. But as blood pools into the lungs, you basically suffocate. And there's all sorts of bad fevers that come at several points during the day. So it has gotten this romantic notion. You know, if you see La Traviata or La Boheme.
Les Mis.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful disease to die of. And I remember writing, it's not beautiful, it's a mess. It's a disgusting mess, both for the person who has it and the person who treats it.
And treatments were awful.
They were non-existent. I mean, they first of all, the four bodily humors still prevailed as the philosophy of the day. So Keats was bled a lot. He also was put on a starvation diet. I love this. It's very Italian. One anchovy per day and one piece of toast per day. And of course, he was prescribed laudanum, which is a tincture of opium. It's alcohol and opium in a liquid form. And he grew to like that a little bit too much, as most of us would. So there weren't any treatments at all that we would call modern or curative.
At what point did medicine, Howard, manage to pretty much control TB? I know not totally, right? Because aren't we kind kind of keeping a nervous eye on a super strain of TB that is pretty resistant to the
drugs we have? It's still the number two infectious killer in the world after AIDS, and sometimes it flips. And so depending on where you live, garden variety TB as well as drug-resistant or extremely drug-resistant TB is running around. It wasn't until 1881 that Robert Koch identified what we call Mycobacterium tuberculosis, but it wasn't until the late 1940s, early 1950s that antibiotics against TB were invented. And of course, you have to take those antibiotics, and it's not a 10-day course. It's a 6 to 12-month course, and people don't like to take medications for that long of a period. And when you stop your antibiotics early, you run the risk of not only being contagious to others, but developing a drug-resistant strain. And so it remains a huge problem, not so much in the United States, although there's about 10 to 20,000 cases a year in the United States, but in places like the former USSR, Asia, and South America, it is running rampant. It is not history by any means.
The last gasps of John Keats, who died of TB on this day in 1821. Howard Markel, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, did you know most college students are not fresh out of high school?
They may be ex-incarcerated. They may be factory workers who lost their jobs. So it's a whole universe of people who need college and want to be in college and don't fit that picture that we have.
How colleges and universities can do more for non-traditional students. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been nearly a year now since the state approved year-round and nighttime hunting for coyotes. And we got to wondering how that change in hunting policy has been working out and whether it's impacted Michigan's coyote population. Adam Bump is with the DNR, back with us again. Welcome back, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
So coyote hunting season used to be closed from, what, mid-April through mid-July?
The hunting season itself was, just in that spring, early summer portion of the year where hunting was closed. But the rest of the year was open, but right.
Why was it closed for those weeks?
So you have a couple things happening then. You have a lot of animals that are having young, birds that are on the nesting. So we have dog training bans in that place to try to protect young animals. And we also, it would be a similar time when coyotes would usually probably have their young by that time, but still have younger pups. So that's the primary historical reason. But year-round coyote hunting is something that has occurred in many states around us. Well, basically, since they've had regulated hunting, they've had no close seasons. So it's not something new,
yeah.
But it was new for Michigan.
So what was the impetus toward opening up hunting all year round and also at night?
I think our Natural Resource Commission had been hearing a lot of complaints and concerns from a variety of different stakeholders. So it went from people in the Upper Peninsula that were concerned about lower deer numbers to suburban and urban folks in southern Michigan that were starting to see more coyotes in their neighborhoods and had concerns that way. So there were direct calls for extended seasons, but also just that level of interest / concern about seeing coyotes.
What is the situation with our coyote population in Michigan? I mean, was there any worry about this hunt impacting the coyote population?
Well, one of the things we talked about when we brought the proposals before the commission about a year-round season and expanding different opportunities was the fact that coyote populations are very resilient, and it's very difficult to have a significant impact on populations on a big scale. So the likely impact if you're trying to reduce coyote populations across the state is pretty low. But providing additional opportunities for people to take coyotes does allow them more flexibility in trying to impact their own little piece of Michigan. So you may be able to have at least a short-term impact right in your backyard or your back 40, but the likelihood of impacting the population as a whole was pretty small.
So this decision that happened last April didn't have the controversy attached to it the way the wolf hunt question has been?
Not nearly the same level of controversy, no, but there are the same sorts of perspectives. A lot of people were frustrated with the idea of having no close season on coyotes, and there's quite a few people that have feelings that, you know, you really shouldn't be going after predators that strongly. So we did hear for some of those groups that felt, why would you need to do this? This isn't going to really have an impact anyway. But nowhere near the controversy that we saw when we looked at managing wolves through hunting.
Adam, do people report their kills? I mean, I'm kind of wondering, do you have any idea how many coyotes have been taken since the season was opened up to year-round?
Well, we do a couple of different surveys. So we'll take and do surveys of people that hold a fur harvester license or a base license and ask them how much time they spent pursuing each one of our fur-bearing species. So we can look at that over time. But there's a lag there in that data set. So we don't have anything from the 2015 or 2016 seasons to be able to look at whether that regulation had an impact on harvest or not.
What did the new policy allow in terms of nighttime hunting, particularly in order to make it safe for the folks who are around while this is going on?
Well, there's been a couple series of changes over the last years that impacted coyotes. So we allowed year-round hunting in the daytime and applied that to nighttime season. So that gave quite a bit more opportunity both during the day and the evening. We legalized the use of number 3 and 4 buckshot, which is just a larger shot size in shotguns, which were previously illegal. And then relatively recently, we made a change to legalize the use of centerfire rifles and centerfire pistols of caliber smaller than .269, which means something to people that are using those.
Yeah.
But it allows a certain number of centerfire rifles to be used in certain areas at night. People have to use calls or the aid of dogs the same as they have historically had to do at night, but it liberalized the time frame and the devices that you could use.
What advice do you give to property and homeowners with respect to coyote awareness?
Try to remove attractants, so don't leave dog food or trash out at night. Even in urban areas, they tend to prey on wild animals, rodents, rabbits, those kinds of things. Be aware that if you see a coyote during the daytime, it doesn't always mean there's an issue or it's an aggressive coyote. They just learn that people aren't a risk. You can make loud noises, yell at them, do those kinds of things to try to instill a little bit of fear in them. But you would be watching for coyotes that start to act more aggressively. And if you're starting to see a coyote in an area, especially this time of year and into the spring when they're either breeding or have young, they can become a little more territorial. So you may keep your pets inside unless you are outside with them. Most attacks on dogs are going to be a territorial attack rather than them trying to feed on a dog.
Ah.
So those are the kinds of things that I would look for, and just trying to be aware that they're probably just behaving like a coyote does, and don't pose much of a risk as long as you take those precautions.
Adam Bump with the Michigan DNR. Always great to get your insights, Adam. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
One business in mid-Michigan has turned coyote population control into a hunter's contest. Knutson's Sporting Goods in Brooklyn, right near the Irish Hills, has a bounty hunt going until March 1st. Tom Knutson is here with us now. Tom, what gave you the idea to make this contest out of coyote hunting?
Well, it was actually my son who came up with the idea. He had seen different contests throughout the country. Most of them were always one weekend only. Big hunts where guys would get together and do different techniques of hunting coyotes. And he decided that, you know, maybe we should do a contest that was more along the lines of a bounty hunt, more of the customer who could bring in the most over a longer period of time, and then see, you know, how big a coyote we could find and try to get an idea of, you know, what sizes are out there, what's going on in the environment.
So when did you start the bounty hunt?
The last week of January. We got everything done and set up for the contest. So we started on the last weekend of January and runs through March 1st.
So how many were you expecting hunters to bring in?
We were expecting, and we were being kind of naive, I guess. We'd have been real ecstatic if we'd have had 30 coyotes brought in.
And how many have you gotten so far?
As of right now, we're at 84, and we still got one more weekend to go.
Well, this has gone beyond whatever you thought it was going to be.
by a long shot, and it actually has alerted us to the true problem of the overpopulation of coyotes.
In fact, let's talk about that. What kind of complaints have you been hearing from people about the coyotes?
Well, the biggest thing is all you have to do is basically step out into any, you know, backyard and listen, and you're going to hear them. They're everywhere. Me and my wife went to Chicago last weekend, stayed with some friends in Orland Park. This is a highly populated area. It had a small pond in the middle of, I would say, 50 homes. I stepped out of the house at about 10 o'clock, you wouldn't believe it. There was coyotes less than 50 yards from the house, in between multiple houses, going off, you know, doing their calls. And it's like, I walked in the house, I said, do you know you got coyotes 50 yards away from here? I said, don't let the cat and dogs out because they won't be around.
And have you heard people coming in talking about that very problem in, like, in the Irish Hills area?
Oh, absolutely. It's throughout the whole state. We've got a serious problem. The contestants that are coming in, one gentleman has 500 acres. In the last 10 years, he's taken 500 coyotes off that property.
Okay, that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, it truly is. Well, I'm interested. I know you're offering a prize for the person who brings in the most coyotes. Can you give us an idea how many, who's the front runner? How many?
There's two guys that are tied at 11.
Okay.
These gentlemen are trappers, mostly. They're using the trapping method because it's open to any type of method to take the coyotes, whether it be hunting and calling, trapping, or some of them are actually using dogs to hunt them.
And then also you're offering a prize for the heaviest coyote. What's the heaviest you've gotten?
41.3 pounds.
And what are people going to win?
$500 for the most coyotes. Second place would be $300 gift certificate. And $150 for third, and the same thing on the heaviest coyote side.
You think you'll do this again?
Definitely. We may tweak it a little bit. My son has talked about, you know, trying to make it more like a true bounty and maybe not do the big prizes, but each coyote brought in, give a certificate for the next year. He's kind of thinking in that direction. It is a very, very surprising results for us. We did not expect to see the pure numbers that are coming in, and it just kind of alerts to what the true problem is with coyotes in the area.
Tom Knutson is with Knutson's Sporting Goods in Brooklyn, and again, the bounty hunt lasts until March 1st. Tom, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Graduate from high school and head off to college. Parents help to foot the bill. That's the image that most of us have about the typical college student. But that image is very mistaken, and Michigan has hurt itself by largely ignoring the non-traditional college student. David Scobie is a visiting scholar at the University of Michigan School of Education who has been looking into this. So glad to have you with us, David.
Delighted to be here.
What percentage of college students in Michigan would you say fit that traditional image that I just described?
Well, if you ask nationally what percentage of students are just out of high school, mm-hmm. going to school full-time, dependent on their parents, the answer is 1 out of 4.
That is stunning.
Yeah. It may be a little bit different in Michigan, but
sure.
That's the national situation.
Yet we all have that image kind of carved in our minds as that's kind of what college is about. So that means 75% of people going to classes in colleges are non-traditional.
And they may be attending part-time. They may be older. About 40% of all college students are age 25 or older. Half of them are financially independent, not dependent on their parents. And that covers a whole range of different life stories. They may be Iraq War vets. They may be the 23-year-old who's bagging groceries or working in construction who kind of flamed out the first time. They may be ex-incarcerated. They may be factory workers who lost their jobs. It's a whole universe of people who need college and want to be in college and don't fit that picture that we have.
And college isn't really set up for these folks, is it?
That's the flip side, that it's not just the public who defaults to this image of the traditional student. It's most academic institutions. In everything from when classes are to rules for financial aid, which favor traditional students, to the way that teachers are trained to have certain expectations of their students.
So how does that translate into challenges, real-world challenges for these non-traditional students? What are some of the stories you've heard?
The first is just the complexity of their own lives. If anything brings the war vet and the barista and everyone else together, it's that instead of being able to organize their life and their world around a central role as college students, they have to squeeze college into whatever else they're doing. So the sheer complexity of the day and the week and the bank account is the first set of challenges. And that means that every little mini crisis, the car breaks down, your kid gets sick. The second set of challenges are actually a little bit less expected. They're emotional. Every single non-traditional student I have ever taught or interviewed for my research points to the sense of insecurity, sometimes even embarrassment at shame, at not having lived out that kind of normative high school to college story. They feel like they have to overcome an emotional barrier. And when they do, there's an enormous sense of power and victory, but there's also a real sense of precariousness. In addition to the social complexity and the economic complexity of the students' lives and the kind of emotional challenges, higher education itself is the third set of barriers. We are, for the most part, set up to default to the traditional image. Here in Michigan, for example, almost all state financial aid goes to young students. If you're out of high school more than 10 years, you're not eligible. The academic calendar, with the large majority of classes meeting once a week during work hours, even something as simple as the office hours for student services or financial aid offices. But beyond those kinds of logistical barriers, infrastructural barriers, we don't understand the large majority of the students whom we serve and whom we're committed to educating have lives different from what we have in mind. That gets in the way of teaching and learning. It gets in the way of staff support.
And if we think of Michigan and we keep hearing we don't have enough trained people for the jobs that are open, are we missing something by not helping this big cohort of non-traditional students get through?
Yes. Here in Michigan, we have an enormous number of non-traditional students. But even beyond that, there's a huge number of folks with some college credits who've dropped out. That's estimated to be about one in every four working adult in Michigan. There are about 700,000 some credit, no degree folks in Metro Detroit. There's an enormous opportunity and need here. And some institutions are doing it well, others not so much. As a higher ed sector and as a state, we haven't turned our minds and our hearts to this in a way that we need to really design educational opportunities that are great for traditional students.
Give us an example of the way it's being done well to serve these students.
A program that I love, part of Evergreen State College in Washington State. They have a program in Tacoma, an urban program that grew out of the African-American neighborhood there. The Tacoma program is small. It has 200 students, and it's a college completion program. Very strong sense of community and peer support. Very strong sense of committed advising by faculty and staff. Their students are 75% federal poverty level, and they have an 80% graduation rate. And part of their secret sauce is understanding and scheduling the time and places of learning around these students' lives. But part of it is culture and climate, creating a welcoming, relentlessly supportive environment. In Michigan, I would say that the less flagship public institutions often do that more effectively. UM Dearborn and Flint are notable examples.
Are they more nimble? Is that part of it, where they're able to adjust and turn course, adjust course a little bit better than the big ones?
My guess is that at base, it's because there's a kind of tradition of service in which they see underserved students as part of their mission.
So what do you see as the challenges for our academic community in our state in order to help these people succeed?
On the one hand, folks, as I was, who have been relatively clueless about this non-traditional majority need to say, how can we learn about these students' lives and needs and redesign educational opportunities and everything from the classes that are taught to the way credits are earned? But on the other hand, we need not to assume that all these students want is quick and dirty workforce training, which tends to be the kind of second default that people make. So we want a higher ed system with a range of long-term and short-term opportunities, from one-year workforce certificates to bachelor's. We're too often defaulting to the assumption that, okay, what these working adults need is the health tech. Whatever students want to do, let's make sure that their learning combines skill building that they need for their work lives with opportunities for reflection and self-transformation that feed the rest of their motives and aspirations.
And what's your advice to someone listening who is in that 75% of the students who are gutting it out and trying to make it as a non-traditional student?
If, as most of them do, they want to return to college and finish maybe something that they feel that they'd started and not finished, it's important, it's empowering. It's worth the struggle to overcome the barriers, but also do two more things. Find a program that recognizes who you are and find a program where you'll have peers and a learning community that will support you. And that usually means not always not sitting in front of a screen. There are some online programs that do foster that community, but for the most part, it's pretty isolationist and quick and dirty.
And don't give up.
Fascinating,
fascinating work that you're doing. David Scobie, visiting scholar at the University of Michigan School of Education. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.